Our text this evening comes from 2 Samuel chapter 14, which is another rather extensive narrative as last week, but again, not as familiar as many, and so we will read it through to get it in front of us. 2 Samuel chapter 14, beginning at verse 1. Now Joab, son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart stood against Absalom. So Joab sent to Tekoa and got a wise woman from there, and he said to her, "Make out like you're mourning and put on mourning clothes and don't anoint yourself with oil and act like a woman who's been mourning over the dead for a long time. And go into the king and you shall speak to him like this." So Joab put the words in her mouth. When the Tekoa woman spoke to the king, she fell on her face on the ground and showed obeisance, and she said, "Grant deliverance, O king." And the king said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Truly, I'm a widow woman. My husband has died, and your maidservant has two sons. Both of them were fighting in the field, and there was no one to stop them. So the one struck down the other and killed him. And why, all the family has risen against your maidservant, and they say, 'Hand over the one who struck down his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. And let us annihilate the heir as well. And they shall put out my coal that is left, not leaving a name or remnant to my husband on the face of the ground.' Then the king said to the woman, 'Go home, and I will give orders in your behalf.' Then the Tekoa woman said to the king, 'Upon me, my lord, O king, is a wrong, and upon my father's house, but the king and his throne are in the clear.' Then the king said, 'Should someone talk to you, you are to bring them to me, and he will not bother you any more.' Then she said, 'Let the king invoke Yahweh your God, that the avenger of blood not utterly destroy and not annihilate my son.' So he said, 'By the life of Yahweh, not a hair of your son will fall to the ground.' Then the woman continued, 'Please let your maidservant bring a matter to my lord the king.' But he said, 'Speak.' So the woman said, 'Then why have you devised something like this against the people of God? And because the king speaks this word, he makes himself guilty by the king's not bringing back his banished one. For we must all die, and we're like water spilt on the ground, which can't be gathered up. But God does not take away life, but devises ways so that he may not keep a banished one banished from him. And now the reason I came to speak about this matter to my lord the king is that the people made me afraid. So your maidservant said, 'I want to speak to the king. Perhaps the king will carry out the request of his servant. For the king will listen to deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would annihilate me and my son together from the inheritance of God.' So your maidservant thought, 'May the decision of my lord the king provide rest for me. For my lord the king is like the angel of God in hearing good and evil. And may Yahweh your God be with you.' Then the king answered and said to the woman, 'Please do not hide a thing from me which I'm asking you about.' And the woman said, 'Speak, my lord, O king.' Then the king said, 'Is the hand of Joab with you in all this?' So the woman answered and said, 'By your life, my lord the king, there's no going to the right or to the left from all that my lord the king has stated. For your servant Joab, he ordered me, and he placed all these words in your maidservant's mouth. Your servant Joab did this to disguise the appearance of the matter, but my lord is wise, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all that's in the earth.' So the king said to Joab, 'Look now, I shall do this thing. So go, bring back the young man Absalom.' Then Joab fell on his face to the ground and showed obeisance and uttered a blessing on the king. And Joab said, 'Today your servant knows that I have found grace in your eyes, my lord the king, because the king has carried out the request of his servant.' So Joab got up and went to Geshur and brought back Absalom to Jerusalem. Then the king said, 'Let him go round to his house, but my face he will not see.' So Absalom went round to his house and did not see the face of the king. Now there was no man so handsome as Absalom, so highly praised in all Israel. From the sole of his foot to the top of his head, there was no defect in him. And when he cut his hair, at the end of every year he used to cut it, for it got so heavy on him. Then he weighed the hair on his head 200 shekels by the royal weight. And three sons were born to Absalom, and one daughter, her name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. So Absalom lived in Jerusalem 2 years, and he did not see the face of the king. So Absalom sent to Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. So he sent again a second time, but he still would not come. So he said to his servants, "See, Joab's plot of ground is next to mine. He has barley there. Go set it on fire." So Absalom's servants set the plot on fire. And Joab got up and went to Absalom to his house and said to him, "Why have your servants set my plot of ground on fire?" And Absalom said to Joab, "Look, I sent to you, saying, 'Come here, let me send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me if I were still there. And now I want to see the king's face, and if there's guilt in me, he can put me to death.'" So Joab went into the king and told him, and he called Absalom, and he came to the king and showed obeisance to him with his face on the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. I don't know, but if you were making molasses cookies and were all cranked up, ready to go, and then went to your pantry and found out that you didn't have any molasses, it would be a kind of an irksome task, but you would have to go to the neighborhood grocery and get yourself some more molasses. It's just a necessary detail to have molasses in order to make molasses cookies. Sort of the situation tonight with the translation of the first part of our passage is a kind of a irksome but I think necessary detail, because various translations give a different impression of the last of chapter 13 and the beginning of chapter 14. If you have the English Standard Version, in chapter 13, 39, it says, "The spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom." And then in chapter 14, verse 1, it says, "The king's heart went out to Absalom." I think that's probably a wrong impression that it leaves there. The verb in chapter 13, verse 39, where it says it longed to go out, it can be translated that way, to long for something, but it's more often the idea of to come to an end, to be finished, to be used up, maybe even to be destroyed, and so on. So that the idea in chapter 13, verse 39, might be more likely something like the king's desire for marching out against Absalom was used up. He just didn't have the enthusiasm for it anymore to bring him to task. And then in chapter 14, verse 1, there is no verb in the first of verse 1. You have to supply it. And of course, the ESV has the king's heart went out to Absalom. It's literally the heart of the king was either upon Absalom or against Absalom. I think it's probably the latter. The king's heart was against Absalom. So far from longing for Absalom and so on, he's anti-Absalom. His heart is against Absalom. I think that's probably correct, because in verse 24, when Absalom is brought back to Jerusalem, David says he can go to his house, but he's not going to see my face. It's not like David was all cuddly and warm and fuzzy over Absalom. Now he is in chapter 18 and so on, more so. But here, he's not. He seems to be keeping him at a distance and so on. So I tend to think that chapter 14, verse 1 should be taken, the king's heart was against Absalom, and that then makes sense of Joab going through the scheme of getting this woman from Tekoa in order to soften up David, etc., to bring Absalom back. If David was really longing to do that, as the ESV seems to imply, why would he have to resort to the woman from Tekoa and go through all that trouble? So that's the irksome detail, just to get through that and to give you a different viewpoint, perhaps, than what some translations will give. Now, having said that, though, we run into a larger problem, don't we, in 2 Samuel 14. Why this account in 2 Samuel 14? Why is this here? Is it just to report give a report of how it happened that Absalom gets back to Israel? Is that all it is? Or, to quote a famous and esteemed Old Testament theologian, is this for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness? And if so, what kind of instruction? is it? What do you make of this? Well, I think there are several matters we can gain from this passage. First of all, I think we can say there's a wisdom that is devious. Verses 1 to 21, there's a wisdom that is devious. Job here appeals to this woman from Tekoa. Tekoa will be eventually, a couple hundred years later, the hometown of Amos the prophet. It's a few miles south of Jerusalem. So he gets this woman. She's called a wise woman. That means she's skillful. She's sharp. She knows how to do things and so on. And so he asks her to go present a kind of a case before David as the head magistrate and to get his judgment, and he tells her everything he wants her to do. So in verses 5 to 11, you have her presentation that she makes to the king when she comes to plead her concern. She's a widow. She had two sons. They were fighting in field and quarreling. There was no one around to intervene and stop it. And one struck the other eventually a fatal blow and killed him. And now the clan is clamoring for her to deliver up the surviving son to be turned over for execution because he took the life of his brother. And in verse 7, there seems to be the hint in what she says that they also have another agenda. If they take out or execute this surviving son, that will free up the land or the inheritance. When the widow dies, there won't be anyone in her family to inherit it, and it might be free grabs for some of the rest of the clan. So they may have a hidden agenda as well. So the reason Joab apparently had put pressure on the king and was trying to get him to bring Absalom back, but if he could get one of the people to make the argument, that might do the trick. So he put her up to this, and she made this presentation, and then in verses 8 to 11, you have the king's decision, which is essentially a favorable decision for her, he said, if anyone gives you any trouble, you're to bring them to me. I'll take care of it. And then at her request to have the whole matter on oath, he gave an oath in Yahweh's name that not a hair of her son would fall to the ground. So case taken. That's the presentation. But notice her technique in verses 12 to 14. She brings up another thing. Now, you know how people are. Sometimes they say, I'd just like to bring something else up, you know. That's what she's doing here. And so the king says, all right. And so in verses 12 and 13, she says, essentially, now, you've done something like this. Just as my son, as it were, is in danger and banished, etc., from the clan, and they're seeking his life, and now you've given permission so that he can come back, etc., and won't be harmed. But, you know, you're inconsistent, David. You're really being hypocritical because you have a son who's banished, and you haven't taken any measure to bring him back. And by doing that, you're really wronging the people of God. And then in verses 15 to 17, after she mentions that, it's just a kind of a by the way sort of thing. Then in verses 15 and 17, she reverts to her own case again. And she says, now the reason I came to you, King David, is because the people around my home locale intimidated me and frightened me, etc. in this. You can understand that, etc. So she went back to her own case in verses 15 to 17. So just in verses 12 to 14, she had this little aside. Oh, by the way, let me mention that you're really inconsistent here, David. And then she swings back off of that so that he doesn't think that's necessarily the main point, though it is. Thank you, follow that. That's a technique. You've seen it before. Let's say you're a woman. Now, if you're a fellow, you're not a woman. But let's say one of you women receives a phone call from another lady, perhaps, that you know. You're not necessarily super close and so on, but you know each other and so on. And this woman calls you up and she says, "How? I've just been thinking about you. How are you?" And you say, "Well, I'm okay, and blah, 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 blah." And she says, "Well, and what about Sally, your daughter? Wasn't she going to Anderson College or Anderson University? This is her first year. How's she doing?" And blah, blah, blah. She answers that. So I'm going to go on. And then she says, "Oh, by the way, while I'm talking to you, would you mind could I borrow that huge punch bowl you have? Because we're having a little reception or a shower for what's her name, who's going to marry that fellow, etc. And we would like to borrow your huge punch bowl for that. Could we do that?" And then she arranges to come by and pick it up the next day. Well, you see what she did. It's not that she was being hypocritical necessarily, but the huge punch bowl was really the reason for the call. She said, "Oh, by the way, while I'm talking, oh yes, but that would seem to be a side issue. That's really the main reason behind the whole call." Well, that's what this woman was doing here. True Southern etiquette going on here. And that's the way the woman... She makes this point in verses 12 to 14 look like it's mainly incidental, but it's really the main thrust of what she wants to do. And so David smells something here, and so he says, now look, verses 18 and following, tell me the real skinny here, he says. Is Joab behind all this? And, of course, in verse 19, the woman says, "By your life, my lord the king, there's no going to the right or to the left from all that my lord the king has stated," which being translated means yes. But it sounds better. So, yes, Joab is behind it. He told me how to do this. But the outcome of it was, verse 21, David finally caved in and he said to Joab, "Okay, go bring Absalom back from Geshur," and so on, he can come back. Now, the thing I want you to notice here is that there's a bit of a problem. She's a wise woman. She did her technique pretty well. But there's a problem, I think. There are parallels that she's drawing here. There are two sons that she has, and there was Amnon and Absalom, David's sons, and Absalom had Amnon murdered, of course. But there were two sons, okay, and one was killed, right? And the other is under some sort of banishment or exclusion. Life of the killer, for instance, with her two sons when they were fighting in the field, the one that committed the offense, who is still surviving, had a provision to run to a city of refuge and to stay there until the case was settled and adjudicated and so on. But in any case, they're under both her surviving son and Absalom are under some kind of banishment for what they had committed and so on. So there are these parallels. And so she's drawing on the parallels, a parallel case and so on. And just as you've allowed my banished son to come back safely, why aren't you bringing your banished son back? So it looks like it's a parallel case. It looks like a very plausible kind of affair. There's a problem, though, with plausibility. Something can be plausible, but not very convincing. I mean, I can work out plausible things. I have conspiracy theories that I concoct. And one of the conspiracy theories is that there's a conspiracy between tire shops, you know, like Goodyear, Firestone, Frank's, those sorts of things, that there are between tire shops and street departments. It goes like this. Right? Maybe you've noticed, if you're driving, even downtown Columbia, there are some manhole covers that are they're not smooth. They're like an inch and a half or 2 inches below the surface of the main surface of the road, and you hit those things. It really jolts your vehicle, and you do that too often, you have to go in for a wheel alignment and so on. Or there's a spot out by our house where that's been that way for 4 years. I don't think it's, they might not be able to repair it. It's really bad, but if you go over it, it just, jerks you like crazy. I go in the left lane, go around it unless there's some dude coming down and I can't do it. Those things that you see, now it's plausible, isn't it? It makes sense in a way, doesn't it? You've got a conspiracy. These fellows in the tire shops say, look, you guys don't repair those things. You leave those potholes or you leave those manhole covers messed up like that and so on. And when we have to get all these wheel alignments, we'll give you a little kickback on the fee for them. Now, I doubt if that's happening, but it's plausible. It makes sense in a way if you think about it. Or what about chiropractors and contractors? You go into your bathroom at home, and what do? You can get lower back trouble. Why? Because these cabinets where you have the lavatory, etc., are so very low. If they would build them 8 to 12 inches higher, you could sort, when you're brushing your teeth, you're not standing up, leaning over, throwing your back out, you can stand straight up and do it properly, right? There's no delicate way to speak about this, but have you ever noticed where the toilet tissue holder is? Now, I know there are little gizmos you can use for portable ones and so on. You put where you want. But the ones that are installed, and I've seen this in motels as well as homes sometimes, you sit there, and you look for the toilet tissue. And it's on the wall behind you. You're supposed to turn and you're throwing your back out to get that stuff, and then it drags on the floor because you have to pull it so far and so on. And you think about it. It makes sense. It's plausible. You've got chiropractors saying to contractors, you keep building those lavatories low like that so people throw their back out and so on, and you put those toilet tissue dispensers in the worst places and so on, and when they come in to get their back treatment, we'll give you a kickback. That's plausible. It makes perfect sense in a way. It's just that it probably doesn't happen. It's plausible, but it's not cogent. What I'm trying to get at here is that this woman had a plausible case. It looked plausible because it was so parallel with all the details, but there was something really wrong with it. Because there's a big difference between unintentional manslaughter, which was what her kids were into, and deliberate, premeditated, carefully planned murder, which is what Absalom had committed. The one had certain provisions until the case was decided. Deliberate, calculated murder was a capital offense and was calling for the justice of execution. They weren't the same kinds of offenses, and therefore, it's a different. It's what David eventually did. He just had them brought back. And you might say, well, there are so many what ifs, aren't there? Because David had already compromised his moral authority in his own calculated taking of Uriah's life and so on. He didn't have much basis on which to carry out execution against Absalom, but he still was the head magistrate of Israel, and he had the responsibility to deal justly with it, and really he didn't. But what I want you to see is not the what ifs, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to go there. I just want you to see that there's a difference. She presented the case as if they were parallel matters. And they weren't. It looked plausible, but they were completely different kinds of offenses. And indeed, there was no repentance either on Absalom's part that we can tell. The reason I mention this is just to look at there is a wisdom that is devious, and it seems to me that you have a case of it here in 2 Samuel 14. You see, there's a wisdom that is not wise. There's a perception that does not penetrate. There's a discernment that does not discriminate. And that's why the Apostle Paul prayed in Philippians 1, 9, and 10, I pray this, that your love will keep on growing in knowledge and every kind of discernment, so that you may approve the things that are superior. Because I don't have time to go beyond the principle here, but because in the debate over various moral and ethical questions in our culture today, oftentimes there's a seemingly plausible, parallel kind of argument being made in comparisons, and you have to be able to see through it. We need to be able to plead with the Lord that we might see through the fallacies, the slick moves, and the plausibilities of mere earthly wisdom. There is a wisdom that is devious. Now, secondly, you can say here, there's a success that is discouraging. Verses 22 to 24, and then 28 to 33. There's a success that is discouraging. Now, think of what Absalom was facing. And there was the murder that he planned of Amnon. And then, chapter 13, then he had to flee. And he fled to the kingdom of Geshur, which was northeast of the Sea of Galilee. And his maternal grandfather happened to be the king of Geshur. So Absalom had to flee, but he fled. He was well taken care of there. That was not destitution. And he had an advocate at court. Joab wanted to see Absalom brought back. Why? I don't know. You tried to penetrate Joab, you're going to have some problems. Maybe Joab thought Absalom would make a good candidate for the next king, etc. But later in the narrative here, he gives Absalom the cold shoulder. So it's hard to tell. But at first, Joab was advocating for Absalom to come back, and he pressed the argument, and so David finally caved in, and he comes back from exile in verse 23. But then there's another hurdle, because he's excluded from the king's presence. You notice that's mentioned three times, verses 24, 28, and 32. He can go round to his house, but he's not going to see the king's face, David says. There's not going to be any reconciliation or that sort of thing. So he's back, but he's unreconciled, etc. And Absalom, of course, wants more than that. I mean, he's been away 3 years in Geshur. And now 2 years, he's been back in Jerusalem. That's a total of 5 years. And he wants to get this show on the road. So Joab, unfortunately, doesn't return his phone calls or some reasonable facsimile of that. And so Absalom has Joab's barley field set on fire, and Joab shows up and asks him why he did that. And Absalom tells him, you need to get this thing cleared up with the king, and so on. So Joab goes in, and Absalom, verse 33, is brought into the king, and there seems to be a reconciliation as Absalom does obeisance, etc., and the king kisses Absalom, and there seems to be a reconciliation of sorts after a total of 5 years. Now, his fate had looked very bleak when he left Israel, fled after he had Amnon killed. But now, look what has happened. It's as if you think in terms of a Monopoly game, it's as if he's passed go and collected $200 again. He's coming out smelling like a rose. No bruises at all. That's the success that is discouraging. When you see wicked men who seem to have a smooth way and it goes well for them.
It was like that in, you might say, on July 20th, 1944. There was a military conference in progress in the Wolf's Lair where Hitler was meeting with his advisors and so on. Someone had placed a briefcase under the table, and there was a blazing sheet of flame, an explosion, and so on. Hitler was staggering outside the bunker. He had a punctured eardrum. His one arm was temporarily paralyzed, but he was alive. And the plot did not take his life. Mussolini was scheduled to arrive that day from Italy, and so he went off finally to meet Mussolini, and he said to him, "Frankly, Deuce, I regard this event as the pronouncement of divine providence." And Mussolini admitted that it was a marvelous escape, and Hitler said, "Marvelous, it's more than that. It's God's intervention. Look at this room, at my uniform. When I reflect on this, I know nothing will happen to me. Clearly, it is my divine task to continue on and bring my great enterprise to completion." Well, that's really discouraging. Now, wholly aside from whether it's ethical or not, etc., to assassinate tyrants and all that sort of thing. It's not even, but that Hitler, being what he was and what he had done and what he had perpetrated, saying that he was under the blessing of God to continue all of that. That's really discouraging to see that. And this kind of success is a problem for faith. The slice of life we see isolated in 2 Samuel 14 can give faith fits. Absalom comes out smooth and there's no trouble for him. This is what the kind of thing that produced many of the cries in the Psalms. Here's a man, Absalom, driven by hatred, guilty of murder, who has friends in high places and gall to force the issue, as he does in verse 32. Then he comes off scot-free. And it sometimes seems like wicked men and women are blessed with success, apparently approved by heaven, and blissfully free of any claims of justice. Well, you know what it's like. Their CAT scans don't show up anything bad. Leukemia doesn't kill their kids. Cervical cancer doesn't devastate their wives. Drunk drivers don't mangle their families. Downsizing doesn't eliminate their jobs. Ill health doesn't blight their ability. Hail doesn't ruin their crops. Conflicts with management don't prevent their promotion. Setbacks never hinder their careers. Recessions never reduce their wealth. Are they then under God's smile? That's the problem of Psalm 73, you might say. And of course, Psalm 73, verses 16 and 17, says that you need to go and worship before you answer that question of whether they are under God's smile. But there is a success that is discouraging and disheartening to the people of God. Now, thirdly, I want to press your patience just a bit. I want you to notice that there's a style that is empty, a style that is empty. Verses 25 to 27. Now, it's as if the writer takes three verses here and says, "Now, look, folks, at what has come back to Israel and Jerusalem." And notice he says, there was no man so handsome as Absalom, so highly praised in all Israel, from the sole of his foot to the top of his head. There was no defect in him. And when he cut his hair at the end of every year, he used to cut it, for it got so heavy on him. Then he weighed the hair on his head 200 shekels by the royal weight. Some think that's 2 or 3 pounds. Some think it's like 5 or 6 pounds. And 3 sons were born to Absalom and 1 daughter. Her name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. Those 3 verses about Absalom. Here's Absalom. He is just the Mr. Israel. He's on the cover of People magazine or all that kind of stuff and so on. And gives the rundown on his hair care and so on, minus Rogaine. And his family and his 1 daughter was a beautiful girl, just like her aunt, after whom she was named Tamar. That's the style, but it's a style that is empty. Matthew Henry, the 1700s biblical commentator, looked at verses 25 to 27. He says, now there are 3 matters that are mentioned here. 1, that he, Absalom, was a very handsome man. 2, that he had a very fine head of hair. 3, that his family began to be built up. But nothing about wisdom or piety or faith or worship. Those are significant omissions. And in fact, it's a bad signal to see a man praised for his physical impressiveness, because you know, if you've read, and we haven't because we've come a long way back. We haven't gone all the way back. But if you've come through all of 1 and 2 Samuel, you know that there's a problem when someone's described only in terms of their physical perfections or impressiveness. You remember King Saul when he became king, 1 Samuel 9:2. Saul was a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. In chapter 10, verses 23 and following, Samuel said, do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? There's none like him among all the people. Saul was the epitome of physical impressiveness and perfection. And he was effective to a certain degree militarily, but covenantally he was an utter failure. And then you go to 1 Samuel 16, don't you? And Samuel's look, the prophet is looking to anoint a successor to Saul among Jesse's sons. And he sees the oldest, Eliab, and he says to himself something like, the guy's got king written all over him, and he's ready to uncork his horn of oil and let it rip and so on. And the Lord says to him, don't look at his appearance or how tall he is, for I've rejected him, for it's not what man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but Yahweh looks on the heart. And now you come to 2 Samuel 14, and you have a third instance of a man who is described solely in terms of his physical impressiveness and perfection, Absalom. And it's a bad signal, because those other 2 situations were negative. If Samuel would have anointed Eliab, the implication of 1 Samuel 16 is that it would have been Saul Act 2. Now you have Absalom. And this is not a good sign. It's sort of like that Chicago bank that once asked for a letter of recommendation from about a young Bostonian fellow from a investment house in Boston. They asked about the young man, asked them to send a recommendation, and they did. His father, they wrote, was a Cabot. His mother was a Lowell. Further back, a happy blend of Saltonstalls, Peabody's, and others of Boston's first families. His recommendation was given without hesitation. Several days later, the Chicago bank sent a note saying that the information supplied was altogether inadequate. It read, we are not contemplating using the young man for breeding purposes, just for work. You see, those things don't really cut it. And that's the case here. What if you had maybe a Presbyterian who was in the Absalom mold? What would it be like? Oh, we could do a little update on Matthew Henry's three-point summary. What would he be like? One, he has a fine, well-paying job. Two, he knows SEC football inside out. And three, he loves his beer and fishing. What a pathetic resume. What an abysmal emptiness that is. That's a style that is empty. And the only way to counter this is, time is of the essence, I'll just have to be simplistic. The only way to counter that kind of emptiness is to look to Jesus. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. The Christ described in Colossians 2:9 in that earth-shattering clause in which Paul says, in him the whole fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. And, verse 10, you have come to fullness of life in him. There is a solution to that emptiness, but he's the only solution to such abysmal emptiness. There is a style that is empty. But at the end of our chapter, chapter 14, 2 Samuel 14, all seems to be resolved at last. But it's not. Because when King David kisses Absalom, he kisses a snake. Let's pray. Do give us wisdom, O God, that is able to discern when it is compassion that is required and when it is justice that must be followed. Give us a fearlessness to follow the truth in such matters. And do give us depth, O Lord. Help us to see beyond hair to holiness, to see beyond a concern for the praise of man to the praise that comes from the only God. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.